The Ukrainian president blasts NATO over its uncertainty to accept his country as a new member. International opposition grows to a U.S. decision to send widely banned cluster bombs to Ukraine. Israelis holding yet another protest rally against judicial reforms by Netanyahu's cabinet a day after parliament gives initial approval to the overhaul. This is News. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. Welcome. The Ukrainian president says it would be absurd if NATO failed to specify when his country would join the military alliance. Volodymyr Zelensky says that uncertainty over the accession would provide Russia with what are called motivation to continue with its terror. He made that comment as NATO members are now in the Lithuanian capital to attend a summit. The alliance is divided over Kiev's membership. Washington says that there is no timetable to offer Ukraine on its accession. President Biden says the war with Russia must end before Ukraine joins NATO. Despite a division, Western powers, particularly the U.S., have been pumping arms into Kiev. Moscow is opposed to Ukraine's NATO membership, as well as the Western military aid to the country. The Kremlin says it's carefully monitoring the NATO summit in Vilnius.
United States President Joe Biden said that Ukraine cannot join NATO until their conflict with Russia is over. That has many wondering if Ukraine's membership is contingent on pursuing a long-lasting war, and the West appears to be making certain that the war will continue, with NATO military spending increasing over 8% this year.
This is the biggest increase in decades, and the ninth consecutive year of increases in our defense spending. So European allies and Canada will have invested over $450 billion extra US dollars since we agreed our defense investment pledge in 2014.
Since 2010, European taxpayers have seen their social safety net gutted under economically far-right austerity demands that there's no money for social funding. In the United States, many say that taxpayer money is urgently needed to fix economic inequality, aging infrastructure, and a lack of public services.
In Chicago, we have a lot of disinvested communities that, for them to pick their heads out of their day-to-day problems, the things afflicting them, and say, let's go wage war elsewhere. I'm not sure they would say such things, but like we said, generations of disinvestment and oppression on the West Side would probably push someone over there to maybe not being so keen about sending billions abroad and rather than keeping them at home.
If they take that $100 billion and invest it in things here in the United States that were working for people instead of lining big businesses' pockets, then I'd be all for it. But you know, and I know, that that's not the way the United States works.
Of those who express an opinion, polls show that just 40% of Americans, mostly Republicans, think that the U.S. is providing too much aid to Ukraine.
It is a lot of money, absolutely, but I do believe that, you know, propagating, you know, U.S. interests around the world and not showing weakness in this moment is probably a priority. I think in the long term it will offer some benefits, so I do think it is something I do support. Especially being Polish myself, being from Eastern Europe.
The money for Ukraine comes despite a disastrous anti-Russia sanctions campaign, which has backfired into the worst Western inflation in 50 years. If Ukraine can't join NATO until after the conflict is over, then that means Western leaders want to spend taxpayers' wages on Ukraine, but without doing any of the actual fighting. However, the massive military spending increases the chances of things spiraling out of control and into a larger war. Ramin Mazahari, Chicago.
The U.S. is facing a chorus of criticism over its decision to supply internationally banned cluster munitions to Ukraine. China's warning of humanitarian consequences.
The irresponsible provision of cluster munitions is highly likely to cause humanitarian issues. Humanitarian concerns and legitimate military and security needs should be addressed in a balanced manner, and the transfer of cluster munitions should be treated with prudence and restraint.
Namao says a dialogue is the only viable way out of the crisis in Ukraine. She urged parties involved in the conflict to avoid fanning the flames of the war and escalating tensions. Also, North Korea's foreign minister is slamming Washington, calling the decision a dangerous criminal act. The move has also angered U.S. Western allies, including the U.K., Canada, and Spain. Cluster bombs are banned by a U.N. convention backed by more than 120 countries. The controversial weapons are considered a major threat to civilians, as they release large numbers of smaller bomblets that can kill indiscriminately over a wide area. Now, staying with that story, EU affairs ministers have refused to condemn the U.S. move to supply cluster bombs to Ukraine. The details in the next report by Jerome Hughes in Brussels.
Spain has just taken over the rotating presidency of the European Union, and on Monday, officials from the country outlined their priorities to the bloc's ministers, as Madrid holds the position for the next 6 months. Spain says the key priority is Ukraine.
Are you concerned that during the Spanish presidency things could escalate potentially out of control? Because we simply don't know how Moscow is going to respond to the United States sending cluster munitions to Kiev. So is that a concern for you?
I cannot answer if it's going to be an escalation or not, obviously. What I can tell you is that Ukraine is very high on the agenda, is the main issue, the main topic of the agenda of the European Union, and is the main question in every single council.
Joe Biden points out that the US did not sign up to a 2010 international treaty that bans the use of cluster bombs. Senior EU officials are refusing to condemn Biden's decision to supply Ukraine with the weapons.
We talk a lot about rule of law, but we know that these weapons are banned by 123 countries. So,
on the military support, it will be done on the European level in full respect for the treaties signed and ratified by the member states.
Cluster weapons contain dozens of smaller bomblets that disperse over vast areas but don't necessarily explode straight away.
At some point, this war needs to be stopped. If not, we will see escalation, because cluster bombing is extremely notorious because of collateral damage. It takes out military targets, but the collateral damage is civilian targets.
Hungary is pushing for a ceasefire in Ukraine, but is currently a lone voice in the EU. Experts say it will not be that way forever. As national governments change within the 27 member states, due to elections or simply because they collapse, as we've just seen in the Netherlands, analysts say there will be a major shift in policy as the electorate grows sick and tired of the ongoing cost of living crisis. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Israeli forces have forcibly evicted another Palestinian family from their home in the occupied East Al Quds, replacing them with settlers. Regime forces stormed the house and arrested several activists. The family has lived in their home for 70 years. Now, earlier this year, an Israeli court ordered the Sab Laban family to vacate their house in favor of settlers. The family fought a 45-year legal battle against regime-backed settler groups to displace them. Palestinian civil society and rights groups have slammed the move. They say it's forcible transfer, which constitutes both a war crime and a crime against humanity under the Rome Statute. Now, the UN says the 218 Palestinian households in East Al Quds facing the threat of eviction. Israel occupied East Al Quds along with the entire West Bank during the 1967 war. It formally annexed the city in 1980 in a move never recognized by the international community. Okay, from Ramallah, let's bring in Mona Candil, our correspondent. Mona, good to have you with us. So they've lived there for 70 years, and they fought this in court for more than 40, 45 years, and finally they have lost their home.
Unfortunately, the Ghith Sublaban family had moved to their property and lived in the home since 1953, as they rented the house from a general custodian for abandoned properties first under the Jordanian authorities, as Al-Quds were under the Jordanian custody, Jordanian authorities since 4 years. However, in 1967, when the Israelis occupied the eastern part of Al-Quds, then the custodian was under the Israeli authorities. The Israeli authorities and the settlers groups claim that this house was owned by a Jewish family before the 1948. For years, as you have mentioned, the family were fighting in order to prove that this property was owned by Palestinians and that they rented it, and they had been living there for over 70 years from the 1953. Several years ago, unfortunately, the Israeli court said that the family, only the father and the father and the mother, are allowed to remain in this house. However, all their children were forced to leave the house. Unfortunately, today the Reit Sublaban family was forced to leave the area by Israeli police and by a ruling from the Israeli court, and the Israeli settlers were allowed to enter the property and the house. Uprooting Palestinians, whether through this through these means of eviction, home demolitions, and other discriminatory policies and practices employed in the first place by Israel to forcibly transfer Palestinian families from East Al-Quds and also from Area C in the occupied West Bank. So every time the Palestinians cannot prove that they have the needed documents, that they own the properties, the Israelis would forge papers and documents and claim that these homes had been owned before the 1948 by settler groups or by Jewish families. However, in many cases, Palestinians had been forced to leave Al-Quds in 1948, and then there were numerous homes and properties had been left abandoned because the real owners were forced out of Al-Quds and even out of the occupied territories completely. They became refugees in Arab countries or even in European countries. So these homes were left abandoned. Other Palestinian homes, other Palestinian families were able to rent these homes in order not to leave them empty, and remained living since the early 1950s. Right. However, after several years, the Israeli authorities and the Israeli settler organization had been doing their utmost in order to prove in the military courts that these homes are not occupied, let's say, or Palestinian, the real owners are not living in these homes, so even Palestinians, other families are not allowed to rent them for over 20 years. This is the case of Reit Sublaban family. At the end of the day, after over 45 years of this battle in the Israeli courts, they were forced to leave the home and to bring Israeli settlers to live there instead of them.
Okay, thanks for that. Mona Kandil in Ramallah. North Korea says its warplanes have repelled a U.S. spy plane that flew over its exclusive economic zone. Pyongyang warned of shocking consequences if the U.S. continues with what it calls the illegal intrusion. Now, the comments were made by the powerful sister of North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. She said that the U.S. military spy plane entered the country's exclusive economic zone 8 times. Kim Yo-jong's comments came hours after a nation threatened to shoot down American spy aircraft. The Pentagon dismissed Pyongyang's accusations of airspace violations. Tensions running high on the Korean Peninsula. The North has condemned Washington's plans to deploy a nuclear missile submarine near the peninsula. Pyongyang says that such actions would create a situation that brings a nuclear conflict closer to reality. The Iranian capital city is hosting the annual meeting of the Asian Parliamentary Assembly's Budget and Planning Committee. Parliamentarians from some 20 countries are attending the event. Speaker of Iranian Parliament addressed the opening ceremony. Mohammad Bagher Ghalibaf said Asia is returning to the center of global economic and political power. He added that the return poses a challenge to the West. Ghalibaf noted that the current transition in the world order can pave the way for reviewing the structure of the international institutions, such as the United Nations. The APA has 42-member parliaments and 16 observers. It was formed in 2006 with the aim of developing common strategies and promoting peace in Asia and beyond. Israelis once again take to the streets to protest judicial overhaul proposed by the far-right cabinet of Prime Minister Netanyahu. The protest erupted after the Knesset gave its initial approval to a bill that limits some powers of the top court. That's part of the reform proposed by the Netanyahu administration. Clashes have been reported between police and protesters who blocked a highway linking to the occupied Al-Quds. The bill must still be passed in two more readings to become law. The changes have sparked one of the biggest ever protest movements in Israel. Opponents say Netanyahu, who is on trial on corruption charges, is trying to use the overhaul to quash possible judgments against him. Let's move on. The British state broadcaster BBC is facing a fifth day of media grilling over mishandling an investigation into allegations of sexual misconduct by one of its presenters. The presenter, not identified publicly, is accused of paying more than £35,000 to a teenage drug addict for explicit pictures and videos in the course of 3 years. Now, critics say that the corporation took a very long time to investigate the allegations. The campaign group, Defund the BBC, says that a row shows the broadcaster has not been able to police itself and instead chose to whitewash the issue. Now, the broadcaster says it's paused the probe while the police examine the circumstances. Another attempt to put a stop to the conflict in Sudan has failed after the army refused to attend a regional peace meeting. The army accuses Kenya, that chaired the talks, of taking sides with its rival paramilitary rapid support forces. The East African regional bloc, IGAD, had invited the foes to a meeting in the Ethiopian capital. The RSF welcomed the initiative and sent a representative to the quartet meeting led by Kenya, South Sudan, Djibouti, and Ethiopia. IGAD has also called for potential deployment of troops to Sudan to protect civilians. A power struggle between Sudanese army and the RSF spilled into a war in mid-April and has since killed thousands of people and displaced millions. Several ceasefire attempts have failed to stop the fighting. Torrential downpours have battered the U.S. northeast, unleashing flash flooding across the region. At least one person was killed in New York State. At one point, more than 12,000 customers lost electricity in the state. Rains have also washed out roadways, overwhelmed rivers, and delayed or canceled flights. More than 13 million Americans are under flood watch. Heavy and persistent rainfall and thunderstorms is still expected across large areas. Many factors contribute to flooding, but a warming atmosphere caused by climate change makes extreme rainfall more likely. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,645 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Iran Sat or Bat 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you. In the limelight.
The Zionist regime and Zionist settlers occupying the Palestinian lands still continue the slaughter of the innocent Palestinians in the West Bank of River Jordan. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Kayhan International noted, although the massacre of the Palestinians has for the moment stopped in Jenin, the murderous Zionists continue the slaughter of the innocents in other parts of the West Bank of River Jordan. Recently, Israeli regime troops, in what is being called an act of invasion, suddenly attacked Nablus and Ramallah to kill more Palestinians, even as an EU delegation visited Jenin to confirm the intensity of the Zionist crimes. Two men, Hamze Maqbul and Khairi Shahin, were killed in Nablus, while the village of Safa in the neighborhood of Ramallah, Abdul Jawad Saleh was shot in cold blood by Israeli regime forces. These crimes against humanity have the full backing of the super terrorist, the United States, even if the regime in Washington denies its complicity and pretends to be a peacemaker. The Americans are the open enemies of Arabs and the rest of the Muslim world, despite their pretensions of friendship with a few gullible regimes and deceiving them to establish diplomatic ties with the illegal Zionist entity. The only solution to the chronic question of Palestine is mobilization of all resources for ending the illegitimate existence of Israel. If not, crisis will continue to worsen the plight of the sons of the soil. The UN is not expected to redress the sufferings of Palestinians. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres may have condemned the organized slaughter of the people of Jenin, but his stance is not going to change anything in the usurped land. His refusal to retract his condemnation of the Zionist regime forces for using excessive force and harming civilians during the recent reducing of several parts of Jenin to rubble, in face of harsh reaction by the Zionist regime, may look brave. It is good news for the press and provides ingredients for political pundits, who are not always correct. Other than this, the world body is totally helpless and cannot force the Zionist regime to obey international law. If there is any real international law, then there is no ground for the existence of Israel in the first place, since there is no justice in spite of the claims of politicians, lawyers, analysts, and heads of government. The cancerous tumor continues to spread. In such a state, the crying need is for Muslims worldwide to knit ranks and deliver the final blow to the Zionist regime. In the meantime, Wafa News Agency reported groups of police-guarded extremist Israeli Jewish settlers performed recently a provocative incursion into the courtyards of Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in occupied Al-Quds, according to witnesses. Witnesses said scores of Zionist settlers entered the compound through the Moroccan gate in groups and performed rituals there under the protection of Israeli regime police officers. Since 2003, the Zionist regime occupation authorities have been allowing Zionist settlers into the compound almost on a daily basis, with the exclusion of Friday, the Muslim day of rest and worship. The Zionist regime captured East Al-Quds, where Al-Aqsa Mosque is located, during the Six-Day War in 1967, in a move never recognized by the international community. Israeli regime occupation forces on July 9th and last night detained at least 9 Palestinians from multiple districts in the occupied West Bank, according to sources. In the north of the West Bank, the Zionist regime troops detained a Palestinian youth as he attempted to cross the Israeli regime military checkpoint of Dotan to the west of Jenin. In Nablus, a Palestinian youth was also detained by Zionist regime army after the troops raided and tampered with the contents of his home, located in the Asira Street. In the south of the West Bank, 2 Palestinians were detained by Israeli regime troops in the city of Al-Khalil. A military raid was carried out in the town of Yatta, which resulted in the detention of 2 Palestinians. The Zionist regime occupation forces also carried out a military raid in Tormosaya town, north of Ramallah, where they detained a 26-year-old youth following intense clashes that erupted in the town. Meantime, the Zionist regime occupation forces raided Shafat refugee camp, northeast of occupied Al-Quds, and detained 2 Palestinians after breaking into their houses.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhal ladhina amanu, O you who believe, واستعينوا بالصبر والصلاة.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu Alaikum. Now it's time to listen to a short speech by Sayyid Muhammad Rizvi.
When you look at the world of Islam, and this is important for us to relate to that, when it comes to the Muslim history, and I'm not really apologizing for the Muslim rulers in any way, no. And it's not that the Muslim rulers were good, most of them very bad. But did they really force Islam over the people whom they conquered? There are two things that we have to keep in mind, and it's not only me as a Muslim looking at history and being biased. Actually, I can quote you contemporary Western scholars of Muslim history who will agree that there is a difference between expansion of the Muslim empire and the spread of Islamic faith. Yes, the Khulafa started Futuhat, and you know our Sunni brothers say, MashaAllah, you know, it was a very good job that they have done. Yes, they militarily conquered surrounding areas from Iran to Iraq to Sham, you know, Palestine, Egypt. These are the areas which were brought under the rule of the Muslims during the time of the Khulafa by military might. But does that automatically translate into the process of forcing the conquered people to become Muslim? No. This is where you have to realize that there are two different things. If I may, you know, use the term, the Khulafa were not in the business of spreading Islam. They were motivated to increase their Baytul Mal. That was the main thing. And I'll just give you one example. Khalifa Umar ibn Abdul Aziz. In timeline, if you look at our own imams, this is around the fifth imam's time. Umar ibn Abdul Aziz sent a letter to his governor in Fars, in Iran, and a similar letter to his governor in Egypt. Remember, Iran on one side, Egypt on the other side, these are kind of frontier provinces of the Muslim empire at that time. There was nothing beyond that as far as Muslim rule is concerned. And the Khalifa basically is writing to these two governors and says, you know, what is the problem? We have been ruling them for decades, almost a century. How come these people in Egypt and Fars are not yet Muslims? This inquiry by the Khalifa itself shows that Muslims conquered these areas, but they did not force those people to become Muslims. So we have to keep these two things separate. Islam did not spread by sword. Muslim rule spread by sword. Because when the governor of Egypt responded back to Khalifa Umar ibn Abdul Aziz, he said, you know, if these people in Egypt, they change their Christian faith and become Muslims, what will happen to jizya, the tax that we get from there? He was more concerned about, you know, jizya and Baytul Mal rather than, you know, bringing them into the fold of Islam. And this you can see everywhere. You go to India, you know, Muslims rule there for centuries. But yet you see Muslims are not in majority in India. I'm talking about United India. You know, because they were not in the business of forcing their religion on the other people. You look at Indonesia, the largest Muslim country in the world, population-wise. No military or navy ever, Muslim army or navy ever set their foot on the in Indonesia. Islam actually spread there by the context of the Sufi missionaries and Muslim merchants. Because of their akhlaq, because of their honesty, because of their integrity, These people were, you know, influenced and they became Muslim. And the main point I would say is that there is not a single example where Muslims, wherever they went, they did not do like what the Christians have done in North America, Central America, and South America. They never went out in a program of eliminating the language of the conquered people, the culture of the conquered people, or the religion of the conquered people. No. They actually interacted with them in a very positive manner. Some of the languages which were produced with the interaction of Muslim immigrants and the local languages. What is Urdu? Urdu is actually, you know, mixture. It's known as, you know, Urdugah is the military camp where armies from different places would come together. So languages, you know, this is Hindi, Sanskrit, and Farsi. This was all, when it came together, you have a new language called Urdu. When the Arabs, you know, controlled and ruled the coast area of East Africa for a long time, the interaction of the Arab rulers with the Bantu people, the original Africans, created this language known as Swahili, which is the coastal language now. So they, Muslims, wherever they went, they were not in this business of eliminating their culture, their language, you know, or their faith either. You look at, let me give you the last example before I come to Mubahala and relate that to this issue. Look at Spain. It was ruled exactly, I don't remember, 500 years by Muslims. And this was actually the route through which this Renaissance and knowledge and science, you know, spread in Europe through the Muslims. Muslims were never a majority in Muslim Spain. They were rulers. And not necessarily very good, rulers either. But they did not force the people, the local people of that area to become Muslims. You know, we take pride in Canada. We're calling ourselves, you know, a multi-faith, multi-cultural society. If you really want to see in history, the first multi-faith, multicultural society would be Spain under Muslim rule, not before it and not even after it. Because when the Christians conquered Spain again from the Muslims, they went through this process of massacre against the Muslims and the Jewish people in there. They were given only two choices. Either you become a Christian or you live. But even when they were living, they were not let go, you know, that easily. Many of them would be killed in that process. And so that is the history of the Christian, you know, communities, the way they conquered. Now, you know, they look at the world of Islam, and alhamdulillah, you know, every fourth person on the globe considers himself or herself to be a Muslim, and they say, aha, Islam, you know, spread by sword. No, keep that in mind, that there were two different issues here.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karimun Adi Ali. حالي حكيم متين غفور شكور ودود قيوم رؤوف صبور مجيد صلي على محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمنين.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
In the United States, the House Oversight Committee has subpoenaed Hunter Biden's ex-business partner, Devon Archer, who served with Hunter Biden on the board of the Ukrainian energy company Burisma. We take a look at the U.S. media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The national broadcaster CBS News has covered this story and tells us more. Congressional Republicans have subpoenaed Hunter Biden's former business partner Devon Archer, demanding he sit for a deposition this week. The Oversight Committee has been investigating the business dealings of several members of President Joe Biden's family. Kentucky Republican James Comer wrote in a letter to an attorney for Devon Archer stating that he played a significant role in the Biden family's business deals abroad, including, but not limited to, China, Russia, and Ukraine. Additionally, while undertaking these ventures with the Biden family, your client met with then-Vice President Joe Biden on multiple occasions, including in the White House, wrote Comer, the Oversight Committee chairman. Devon Archer's potential testimony to the GOP House Oversight Committee is a significant milestone in the congressional probe. Devon Archer served alongside Hunter Biden on the board of Burisma, a Ukrainian energy company, beginning in 2014. During this period, then-Vice President Joe Biden was deeply involved in Ukraine policy, an era when his opponents say the energy firm was involved in corruption. An independent forensic review of Hunter Biden's laptop data by CBS News confirmed hundreds of communications between Hunter Biden and Devon Archer, specifically emails that suggest working meals were arranged before or after Burisma board meetings. Devon Archer is widely believed to have facilitated Hunter Biden's entry onto Burisma's executive board. In February, Kentucky Republican James Comer informed Hunter Biden and the president's brother, James, that he is seeking documents and communications from the Bidens as part of his committee's probe into any possible involvement by the president in their financial conduct, in particular in foreign business deals with individuals who were connected to the Chinese Communist Party. James Comer accused them in his letter of receiving significant amounts of money from foreign companies without providing any known legitimate services. White House spokesman Ian Sams tweeted on 10th of May that the committee was really just microwaving old debunked stuff, whilst offering no evidence of any wrongdoing by the president. House Republicans have shown no evidence of any policy decisions influenced by anything other than U.S. national interests, Sams wrote. After reviewing thousands of records subpoenaed from four banks, the House Oversight Committee said in an interim report last month that some Biden family members, associates, and their companies received more than $10 million from foreign entities, including payments made during and after President Joe Biden's vice presidency. But the White House countered that Republican investigators could not point to a single Joe Biden policy that was unduly influenced. The 36-page interim GOP report released by James Comer accused some Biden family members and associates of using a complicated network of more than 20 companies, mostly LLCs, formed when Joe Biden was vice president and used incremental payments over time to conceal large financial transactions. From a historical standpoint, we've never seen a presidential family receive these sums of money from adversaries around the world, James Comer said. After the report's 11th of May release, Abby Lowell, an attorney for Hunter Biden, said the committee was redoing old investigations that found no evidence of wrongdoing by Joe Biden. Devon Archer was convicted in 2018 of securities fraud and conspiracy to commit securities fraud for his role in a scheme to defraud a Native American tribe and multiple pension funds. His conviction was overturned later that year, and U.S. District Judge Ronnie Abram wrote in her decision, she was left with an unwavering concern that Archer is innocent of the crimes charged. The conviction was later reinstated by a federal appeals court. Devon Archer lost an appeal of that decision earlier this month. He has not yet been sentenced. The national broadcaster Fox News Channel has also covered this story. The House Oversight Committee has subpoenaed Hunter Biden's former business partner Devon Archer to appear for a deposition this week in its investigation into the Biden family's business dealings. Oversight Committee Chairman James Comer, Republican of Kentucky, wrote in a letter to Archer's attorney that he played a significant role in the Biden family's business deals abroad, including but not limited to China, Russia, and Ukraine. Additionally, whilst undertaking these ventures with the Biden family, your client met with then-Vice President Joe Biden on multiple occasions, including in the White House, James Comer wrote in the letter. Devon Archer, who served with Hunter Biden on the board of Ukrainian energy company Burisma, lost an appeal last week to have his unrelated 2018 conviction and one-year federal prison sentence for a scheme to defraud a Native American tribe thrown out of court. Hunter Biden did not have a connection to the fraud scheme. The committee has been seeking communications and related documents as part of its probe into possible involvement by President Joe Biden in any financial crimes or misconduct, particularly in relation to the family's foreign business dealings. According to CBS News, James Comer accused the Biden family in his letter of receiving significant amounts of money from foreign companies without providing any known legitimate services. The New York Post has also covered the same story. House Oversight Committee Chairman James Comer on Monday issued a subpoena to former Hunter Biden business partner Devon Archer, demanding testimony related to the panel's probe into the Biden family's overseas business schemes. The subpoena compels Devon Archer to testify before the Oversight Committee on Friday morning on Capitol Hill. A source familiar with the proceedings told the New York Post on Monday that James Comer, Republican of Kentucky, has also issued subpoenas to two banks for Archer's financial records and those of Elena Baturina and Rosemont Seneca Thornton. Rosemont Seneca Thornton, a company linked to Archer and first son, Hunter Biden, reportedly received $3.5 million wire transfer from Baturina, Russia's richest woman, and the widow of Moscow's famously corrupt former mayor, Yuri Lushkov, in 2014. Both information that the committee has reviewed and public reporting indicates that Devon Archer played a significant role in the Biden family's business deals abroad, including but not limited to China, Russia, and Ukraine. James Comer writes in a letter informing Devon Archer's attorney, Matthew Schwartz, that his client has been subpoenaed. Additionally, while undertaking these ventures with the Biden family, your client met with then-Vice President Joe Biden on multiple occasions, including in the White House. Devon Archer's testimony is critical to the committee's investigation, James Comer wrote. Devon Archer was Hunter Biden's business partner in a number of transactions involving foreign nationals and foreign companies. Archer is associated with corporate entities that the committee has identified and the Biden family's role in each of them. Furthermore, he has significant information regarding the purpose of these companies and knowledge of relevant documents related to the committee's investigation, James Comer adds. Devon Archer, 48 years old, was convicted and sentenced in February of last year to 1 year and 1 day in prison for his role in a scheme to defraud a Native American tribe of some $60 million in bonds. Devon Archer's appeal was rejected by an appellate court last week.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1930 to 2030 UTC on the following frequencies. 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa. And FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood ghudde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Majh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Ayatollah Khamenei elaborates on six key points of Imam Khomeini's testament, June 4, 2018. If a nation wants to rid itself of the pressures from aggressors, and today the bullying of the U.S., it must stand up to the U.S. with full strength and determination. Just take a look at the behavior of American statement, the U.S. president and his cabinet members, and observe their rhetoric. These failures are reflected in the behavior of American politicians and in their discord, disagreement, and decisions. That is the way the global bullies behave. What should one do to confront this bullying? The imam's advice was to resist. Fortunately, today all the political groups in the country express their loyalty to the path of the imam. This is an auspicious phenomenon. This was not the case in some eras after the revolution. There were some political movements that openly talked about turning their backs on the imam's path.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Fortunately, today, political groups in our country talk about their inclination towards the thoughts and path of the imam. One of the most prominent points of the imam's path, which is reflected in his testament and all his remarks, is the need for determined resistance against covetous, arrogant power. The Iranian nation and all the different political groups, as well as the elites inside the country who are loyal to the imam and his thoughts and decisions, must safeguard this stance with full strength. The imam himself had a similar attitude. He never stopped supporting the oppressed. Throughout the world, out of his disdain toward the global tormentors, he used to refer to the Palestinian cause as a central issue at all the time. In his testament and his remarks, he made explicit the point that he considered the oppressed nation's urge for support as important. He openly announced his support for the rights of the oppressed Palestinian nation as well as other oppressed nations. This is the path of the imam. That is the imam's way and advice. Fortunately, the Iranian nation and the government officials have pursued this path. And it is 30 years now that you, the Iranian nation, have been successful and have defeated the enemies whenever it faced American arrogance.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.